So how are all of us doing with those New Year's resolutions? You know, it's interesting. There are so many self-help books out there, and what they do, I've realized, they actually make predictions. So eat more vegetables and you will feel better. Exercise 30 minutes a day and you will be healthier. Reduce clutter and you will live fully and feel happier. So I have a friend who has just started the new year by applying to her clutter a test. It's a test. She holds each item in her hands and she asks herself, does this bring me joy? If it does, she keeps it, and if it doesn't, she gives it away. She's doing pretty well so far. She's given away her mirror, her exercise bicycle, and all of her bras. So when we ask ourselves what predictions are we willing to make, it helps to remember that a prediction is usually dependent on some behavior that follows. And where do these predictions come from for us, for Unitarian Universalists? I think they start with our seven principles, including that foundational one, respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person. This principle is a statement of our values, and it's in a way, it's an expression of what we cherish, our ethical plan. And if we actually carry out an ethical plan that involves truly respecting the inherent worth and dignity of every person we meet in our lives, it will happen. We will offer them respect for their inherent worth. And this is the way it is with all of our values. Consider the values of this community, specifically the values that developed in your visioning and values process over the last year. And one of those values is, we discovered, love. Love, we've said, is at the heart of this community. And from that love, there comes this value of community and a commitment to create community both inside these walls and outside. From that love comes a commitment and value of justice. And so this community is committed to working for justice inside and outside these walls. And also there is inherent in the values that this community has expressed through this visioning and values process a commitment to engage diversity in all its forms within ourselves, within this community, and wherever we are outside this community. That engagement with diversity is what allows us to build authentic relationships with people who are different. And guess what? Everyone is different. Each one of us is unique. So even within this community, we can't tell from the outside what our diversity is, because there is so much diversity inside each one of us. And if we bring the curiosity and the love that is at the heart of this idea of engaging diversity into all our relationships, then they will become more authentic, more honest, more aware of all the ways in which we have beautiful differences. And we can predict what a change it would make in the world if everyone did that. This idea that's fundamental to our expressions of values is the deep authenticity of the self, the idea that we seek in ourselves what it is that makes us who we are, and we try to live that out in the best possible way in our lives, whether we're talking within our families or our workplace or the world at large. And this is a living from the heart that makes us human. In the life of the solitary human being and the life of the collective human nation, the flourishing of humanity depends on our ability to engage the heart. And this means not living from the despairing heart, or the bitter heart, or the vengeful heart, but living from that loving and compassionate heart so that we can move past despair and past bitterness, past vengeance, to clarity, compassion, and courage. One of the things that helps save us from vengeance and despair and bitterness is humor. Humor. Humor helps, especially if we can laugh at both the situation and at ourselves. So I want to tell you a true story now about my daughter, Jamie, who as a very young adult found herself in a very difficult position in her workplace. From the time she was a teenager, my little girl was a very committed, reliable worker in her part-time job in retail sales. And she was so committed and so reliable that she eventually became a manager. And she was grateful always to the managers she had who mentored her and nurtured her and encouraged her as she learned this trade. Well, she did such a good job that she got a promotion, this time to become assistant manager of a much larger store. And the manager who was in place was a man who seemed nice at first, but then things changed. He became highly critical. And she realized that every time she made a request, whether it was for some time off or she had an idea for a different arrangement of the store, or she thought that these store staff members would work best in this particular area of the store, he said no. And at first she thought, well, he just has different ideas. But then she realized that she and the other three women of color who worked in the store were always the ones who were told no, whereas the white workers in the store were told yes when they came forward with their ideas. She began to think that maybe she had just not really understood her work or her responsibilities. And she alternated between being really angry and bitter with him and thinking that there was something wrong with herself. And she struggled with this alternating anger and despair. And eventually, she decided to talk with him about what was going on. And he acknowledged that he was doing exactly this. And he laughed at her and he said, "You can talk to whoever you want, but they will not believe you. They'll believe me because I'm the manager. They won't believe you. You can't win," he said. Well, that was dismaying. And she sank to a place of despair and despondency that was terrifying. I encouraged her to look at the website of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And when she did, she discovered that the very things she was experiencing were identified as behaviors that were illegal. And she came back to me with this hope that perhaps there actually was a way to insist that he stop this illegal behavior. And it was a challenging turnaround for her, because she still was torn with this sense that maybe it would always be what he said and not what she said. She checked in her company's human resources manual and found that, as she expected, if she had an issue, she was supposed to bring it first to the manager, and then to the manager's supervisor, and then, if need be, to the supervisor of the supervisor. And then, obviously, there was an out. If the manager was part of the problem, or the supervisor of the manager was a problem, then she could go up in the chain of command without going through those early steps first. The problem was, she knew the manager, the supervisor of her manager, and trusted that person, but that person was on leave. And the person who was filling in was the supervisor of the supervisor, who therefore had far too much work to do and too many stores to be responsible for, and on top of that was actually away on vacation. So that meant the supervisor of the supervisor of the supervisor. And she didn't know that person. And she, again, had this self-doubt that it will be just a useless exercise. This supervisor doesn't know me, and he's the manager, and they're going to believe him. She kept finding it easy to buy into his account of the situation. But we talked about what the website of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission said. We talked about the illustrations that it gave and how it was clear that his behavior was illegal. We talked about the impact of his behavior on the other workers with whom she felt great solidarity and for whom she had great love and respect. And after a while, humor actually began to emerge. She began to imagine what his face would look like if someone from the EEOC came in and said, "What you're doing is illegal." She began to imagine how her coworkers would laugh with relief when they realized, finally, that what he was doing was illegal. And she decided that she would go ahead and at least begin the process with the EEOC. So she filled out a written complaint, and she went in and she talked to someone who was tremendously encouraging. But she came back to me again to share her concern that perhaps this wasn't the right course. Clearly, she needed to resist the bad behavior of this manager. Clearly, she needed to support herself and her coworkers who were being discriminated against. But she was worried that the force of the EEOC would come down as much on the company as on this manager. And she loved the company. She loved the people who had nurtured her and mentored her. And she didn't want to be disrespectful of the gifts that they had given her in her process of growing into adulthood. So what she decided was that, even though she didn't know the supervisor of the supervisor of the supervisor of the manager, she would at least make a phone call to that person and invite a conversation. And so she did. She decided ahead of time that she'd leave a message on the voicemail if the person didn't immediately pick up the phone, and that's what happened. She left a message saying, essentially, "I am considering filing a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission about the behavior of my manager, but I thought before I did that I would let you know so that we could have a conversation, and perhaps I wouldn't need to file the complaint." She got a call back within half an hour, and they talked extensively. And the next morning, that supervisor of the supervisor of the supervisor of the manager was in the store before it even opened, and she sent the manager home. And then she proceeded to interview every staff member who worked in the store. And the manager never came back. He was fired. And Jamie was put in his place as acting manager of the store. And her future with the company was very rosy, because they saw in her not only a person of intelligence and resources, but also a person with concern and compassion and loyalty for the company and for her coworkers. So I tell you that story because of its larger application. This story is about one person, but it's the story of all of our lives, in every situation, in every context, individually, in the workplace, in the family, in the nation, in the world. Because it says resistance, yes, but resistance alone is not enough. It's negative. What's needed is response, carrying our own message into the world, carrying our values into the world. So as long as Jamie struggled only with ways to resist her unfair manager, she was stuck in a cycle of he said, she said, where her internal dilemma revolved around she was right, he was wrong, or maybe she could never win. It was only when she took a step back from her own need for resistance and began to see clearly the implications of her situation for other workers in her company, for the company itself, for the values of fairness and compassion and solidarity, only then was she able to craft a response. Cornel West talks about Jesus laughing. And we don't always think about Jesus laughing because we usually think of Jesus as a great spiritual teacher, and with the distance of 2,000 years, he becomes a solemn and tragic figure. We might sooner think of the scholarly and reserved W.E.B. Du Bois breakdancing than thinking of Jesus laughing. And yet the best research into the historical Jesus suggests that day-to-day life with him was filled with humor. His classic remark about response was in answer to a question about adherence to Jewish dietary laws, a very serious matter at the time. And I can imagine the solemn question, and then the hilariously unexpected reply, a reply that referred to human bodily functions. Jesus said, it's not what comes into us that defiles us, it's what comes out. The question for us human beings is, how do we wish to respond? What do we wish to have come out of us and into the world? Will we live from our hearts and carry our values? What we do and what we say, will they affirm our most cherished principles? Let us not be confined to resistance. Let us open our hearts and respond. I believe we can do this. I believe we Unitarian Universalists can do this. And I believe that many, many people who are not Unitarian Universalists can do this. And I believe that because we can do this, because we are human beings with hearts who respond and not just resist, I have predictions to share, prophecies, truths about our future. So I'm going to tell you what I think will emerge from this difficult time in humanity's existence. Just like the happy results of all the self-help books, if you actually do what they say, the future will emerge not from passivity. It will emerge only if we craft an affirmative response that cherishes the values in our hearts. So here they are, my predictions and prophecies and truths. And if you hear something that you believe, something that makes sense to you, something that resonates in your heart, I invite you to rise in body or spirit, keeping in mind that if you're not comfortable standing, rising in spirit as you are seated is good enough. So, my predictions. Black Lives Matter. Women's rights are human rights. No human is illegal. Science is real. Love is love. Kindness is everything. So you rise. We, humanity, rise. What we imagine, we can create. We can make these predictions, the future we long for. And I say to you, Namaste. The spirit in me sees the spirit in you.